Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in a weird way. And today, I'm very excited to have writer Julia Prescott here with me. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
For those of you who aren't as familiar with Julia's work, please let me give you a rundown of her life. Julia was born and raised in North Hollywood with two parents who came out to L.A. to make it and was infected by the industry bug. She went to an arts magnet high school and carpooled with the sisters from, is it Haim?
Haim, yeah.
Wow. before moving on to an arts college to study cinematography until it broke her soul. It was her time working at a three-screen indie theater in Berkeley that helped her find her way, and then she went to film school at Chapman to practice her writing skills. She started doing stand-up and interning at Warner Brothers, FX, and Comedy Central, pretty much everywhere. Even her stint working at Disneyland, however, did not stymie her passion for film. Right before she hit the graduation stage, she got her first writing gig on MAD, a Cartoon Network show produced by WB, a connection that she got through her internships. It was the toughest job of her life, and that's where she learned to write. Julia then moved on to write for the Aquabats Super Show before playing a character on the show in season 2. And then nothing. She hit a dry patch and got further into stand-up and writing for herself. And then the animation studios came calling. Disney, DreamWorks, Nick, Cartoon Network. She wrote for all those places before selling her own shows to WB and Adaptive Studios. In 2018, she finally got to see her own show made, that's Townies, which she describes as an OC in the Old West horny teen comedy western. All right. It stars Natalie Palamides as a girl named Boy,
yeah,
attempting to become the world's first hangwoman executioner. Since she's sold a show to Disney, which is a little hush hush, and written a Simpsons book and the book Basic Algebra for Basic Bitches. There's a lot of B's.
There's a lot of B's. I like alliterations.
And along the way, she also started co-hosting a Simpsons podcast, which has gone through multiple iterations and titles with Ellie Gertz, and has written an episode of The Simpsons for its Treehouse of Horror series. So she will be credited as Julia Prescott.
The part I was born to play, baby.
Oh, what a dream come true.
What a dream come true.
Julia, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Addams Family Values. Can you give us a little explanation of why this is one of your fave genre films?
Well, I feel like I've been thinking a lot about comedies in the 90s lately because, you know, I write comedy and I'm also just starting to dip my toe into feature writing. I've been primarily just TV and only TV. And frankly, the thought of writing a feature scared the hell out of me for years and years.
And also Addams Family Values, because it's got horror sensibilities to it. It's a toe dip into genre as well.
And I really, really like genre. I feel like, you know, I made a Western, and some of my student films in both high school and college were, I think I made like a film noir and was like really into sort of why I started with cinematography. I was really into black and white cinematography. Ed Wood was one of my favorite movies that really inspired me. And I want to say also my like thesis film, quote unquote, at the end of high school was an adaptation of a Twilight Zone episode. So I was very much into genre very early on. And I've been thinking a lot about the kind of movies that have inspired me that I want to emulate in my own work, and also thinking about the difference in what, you know, feature comedies are now versus what they were when I was growing up. And so Addams Family Values was firmly in that timeline of me, you know, starting to pick out the movies and the TV shows that I wanted to watch versus what my parents put on, even though they had good taste too. But, you know, sort of that autonomy that led me to these sort of North Stars. And also, I will say, connecting back to my parents, the reason why Addams Family Values was around and was so prominent in my childhood, speaking of my Hollywood parents, they came here and they had other friends that were doing similar things, acting and writing and all that stuff. My mom had a friend who had a bit part in this movie, and she plays dementia at the end.
Dementia!
Everyone's favorite. And, you know, so great. She had, like, I want to say one or two lines and made such an impact. And so that's why my mom bought the VHS. But then I benefited because every time I was sick from school, I would watch, you know, either this or Wayne's World 2 on VHS. And I would only sequels. I only watched sequels growing up.
It's like only listening to Weird Al's music and never hearing the original. I mean, if you're only going to watch sequels, this is the one to start with.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't seen Adam's Family Values, today's episode obviously will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Adam's Family Values first, this is your shot. Now that you're back, let me introduce Adam's Family Values. Written by Paul Rudnick and directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, Adam's Family Values stars Angelica Houston and Raul Julia as Morticia and Gomez Adams. They have a baby named Pubert, and Wednesday and Pugsley Adams attempt and fail to kill it. So they hire a nanny, Debbie Jelinski, played by Joan Cusack.
I can show you all my references so you know I'm not a homicidal maniac. Of course you're not.
You're too young.
Debbie seduces Uncle Fester, and to keep the meddling kids from uncovering her plan to marry Fester, kill him, and take his money, she convinces Gomez and Morticia to send the kids to Camp Chippewa, where a mean girl, Amanda Buckman, is determined to torture the outcasts.
I'm Amanda Buckman. Why are you dressed like that?
Like what?
Like you're going to a funeral. Why are you dressed like somebody died?
Wait.
But they also meet Bookworm Joel, who falls for Wednesday. Meanwhile, Debbie and Fester get engaged and meet each other's families, giving her a glimpse at her horrifying new in-laws who terrify her to no end. Debbie tries to kill Fester with a boombox in the bathtub on their wedding night, but it doesn't work, so she forces him to sever ties with his family and move into a new house with her.
After we've made love, you can never see your family again.
What?
Otherwise, I could never really enjoy myself. I could never give myself completely.
Pubert turns into a blue-eyed, golden-haired baby, a disease.
Stay back! He's very sick!
From a stressed home life, they're told, Gomez is depressed. At camp, Wednesday and Pugsley are subjected to hours of Disney movies until they agree to participate in a Thanksgiving Day play. They agree to participate, but it's a ruse to capture their enemies, set the camp ablaze, and escape in a van.
The gods of my tribe have spoken. They have said, do not trust the pilgrims, especially Sarah Miller. Gary, she's changing the words.
And for all these reasons, I've decided to scalp you and burn your village to the ground.
Debbie, meanwhile, blows up the house, but Fester just won't die. So she holds him at gunpoint and admits her sinister plan that she didn't really love him.
Look at yourself! You're a nightmare! You're the missing link! You shouldn't be married, you should be studied! You're a big, dumb, weird thing! No woman in her right mind could love you!
Thing, however, comes up and helps Fester, and then the whole family is reunited back at the Adams house before Debbie finds them, ties them to electric chairs, and reveals her sordid history as a black widow.
So I killed. So I maimed. So I destroyed one innocent life after another. Aren't I a human being? Don't I yearn and ache and shop?
Upstairs, baby Pubert escapes and thwarts Debbie's plans by switching up the wires, electrocuting Debbie to a pile of ashes. Months later, Fester gets smitten with cousin It's Nanny dementia, and Wednesday tells new boyfriend Joel she wouldn't fail like Debbie if she were trying to kill her husband. She would just scare her husband to death. Joel lays flowers on Debbie's grave and a hand, presumably Thing, shoots up to grab him. He screams, she laughs, a lovely match.
I love it. Oh my God. I mean, what more is there to say?
There's a lot. So, Paul Rudnick, this was his first solo writing credit. And he had actually done some script doctoring on the original Addams Family. And so you can see his mark on that. So it felt like a natural thing for him to kind of step in after he had worked with Scott Rudin on Sister Act. But, you know, this was his first one that kind of launched and was just like, okay, this is a name, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was kind of riding on this wave of the first film's success because it was a really big success. No one really knew what was going to happen with it, but it did really well at the box office. So that meant that Paramount gave them a lot of free room. He said, quote, "The first film had done so well, so the studio was eager for a sequel. And because Scott managed to reunite that amazing cast and Barry Sonnenfeld, who was the terrific director, I was brought on board too. But I think we were allowed to get away with a lot more because of that first movie had been so successful. The reins were very loose."
And so, it shows, I want to say.
It does. I mean, there's something that, like, for instance, and, you know, this is another note that I had. It is a movie that has two musical numbers in it that are Thanksgiving themed. And it is strange in that it is very clearly set in a summer camp, but they're doing Thanksgiving musicals. And one of the reasons why they were able to do that is they wanted something dumb and they made it work.
That is the best.
Here's a quote.
What a great lesson.
"No one has ever questioned why they're doing a Thanksgiving play in the middle of the summer, but it's earned its keep." And this is Rudnick. "Everyone involved in the film was a big fan of musical numbers, and there'd been a terrific number in the first one. I wrote the lyrics, and Mark Shaiman, the wonderful composer of Catch Me If You Can and Hairspray, wrote the music. We couldn't resist having a number, and somehow, we wanted children dressed as turkeys and pumpkin pie."
Yeah, I mean, for me, that is such an argument of don't overthink it. And just like, you know, again, taking a creative swing and saying, okay, this is already tonally such a weird, specific movie. And it fits within that because yeah. I feel like the world that we inhabit in this movie is already so bonkers that, you know, I didn't question it when I saw it. And now I think by multiple accounts, it is considered one of the greatest Thanksgiving movies of all time. People yeah. watch it.
It's a summer movie that's a Thanksgiving movie as well.
Yeah. And I know that it also got released around Thanksgiving. So maybe that played a part into it as well.
And
I'm not sure.
Probably the studio being like, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They like checked their schedule very quickly and said, yeah, all right, you're a genius.
Actually, yeah, we have a lot of Thanksgiving movies.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, what other Thanksgiving is there? Son-in-law?
there's a few. We actually did a Who Shot Ya episode with Thanksgiving movies and it really jogged my brain.
Did
and
you
I
do What's Cooking?
Didn't do What's Cooking. What's the one? Pieces of April.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
I have, obviously.
We shan't talk about it. It'll be a lopsided conversation.
But I would love to maybe talk just for a second about the kind of setting up of these big swings and making them work. Because that's, you know, a lot of what this movie is saying we wanted this weird thing and we're going to work real hard to fucking get it.
Yeah. And it's, I think, this movie also makes me think, if we're talking about the specificity of 90s comedies, the Brady Bunch movies, to me, really made an impact when I watched them as a kid. And then later, as an adult, I was so happy to see that they held up. And especially watching it as an adult and thinking back, like, how did they get away with it? I think especially now, people are so precious with their IP. And you find that everything is, you know, handled with kid gloves. I work a lot in kids animation, and I've worked on multiple projects that have come from these sort of legacy IPs where they're even more mm-hmm. protective of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have worked on that. And then I hear the arguments people have or criticisms of Star Wars. And I'm just like, it's so hard to make a thing, you know, when you have so many people looming over your shoulder. And I feel like that's the culture now. But back then, it's sort of mystifying that they were able to take this legacy IP and make it as weird as they wanted and have that long a leash. I know that this is a sequel. So you're, you know, riding on the success and you're just naturally going to get a longer leash because what worked in the first one, you know, they think is going to work in the second by some degree. But it's just bizarre to me to sort of look back and go, why don't we still have that now? Why can't mm-hmm. we just sort of hand the reins to creatives and let them do what they want to do? Is it because, you know, entertainment is run by two companies right now? I'm not sure.
Gosh, Julia, I don't know. Maybe it is.
We're asking the big questions. I'm sorry.
Maybe it is. I do want to talk about quickly first the PG-13 rating of this movie. Because there is the joke right in the beginning. Everyone knows it. When you have a new baby, one of the elder children has to die. And then you have Wednesday and Pugsley trying to kill this child.
Yeah.
And that you just start the movie out like that. And Rudnick had said that there weren't any cuts to make it PG-13 that he could remember. It was just like, this
Amazing.
Is what it was, and it was PG-13. And he said, I remember there was one moment on set where Barry called his wife gleefully and said, guess what? Today I threw a baby off a roof. So once that proved normal, there were very few boundaries.
Yeah, I think I read maybe the same quote, but just like, we were bouncing babies off the rooftop and we were doing all this stuff. I think that it being the Addams Family definitely, you know, accounts for getting away with it because, you know, by definition, they're crazy and they're kooky. So you can't really, you know, form a big argument. They have to deliver on that promise. But I think that, you know, also that leash really becomes apparent in these kid scenes. I can see so many people at studios, executives just wringing their hands over, you got to cut that, you got to cut that. I worked on an Amazon show once, and I learned for the first time, you know, how powerful mom comments on Amazon are.
Okay.
And so that was its own sort of realm. And, you know, another thing of how this is very much indicative of its time and place, that it was able to have these scenes, that it was able to have like a very big plot line out of the gate of murder of their own innocent baby sibling.
Yes.
And we're all laughing.
Yeah.
I was laughing.
Well, you know, I mean, it says something about like, if you are going to do something wild, you got to set it up immediately. Mm-hmm. And then people were like, well, I guess this is the world that we live in.
Yeah. And it served a purpose because it fed into the greater plot, which was getting Debbie to come in and be the nanny that they are, even though their parents seem to be delighted by their antics, you know, they are a problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's three children running around a lot of windows.
Yeah. On that, we're going to take a break. We're going to come right back, and we're going to get into some of those production design details and also some anecdotes from some of these actors and how they were preparing for these very strange roles. We'll be right back. Hey, April here. Let me tell you about a product that is sponsoring us now. Very, very exciting. Let's say that you're getting ready for work and you're looking at a pair of sweatpants, which you would really love to wear. And then you're looking at your dress pants, which are going to dig into your gut like all of my pants do and leave a mark immediately. So what do you do? Now, thanks to Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants, you really don't have to decide between the two. With Beta Brand, you never have to sacrifice comfort or function for style because they've got all these stylish dress pants with the stretch fit and feel of yoga pants. It's almost like you're working out at your desk. And you can choose from dozens of colors, patterns, cuts, and styles like boot cut, straight leg, skinny, cropped, and more. And my God, they've got a pair with 8 pockets. Yes, 8 pockets. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their first order when you go to betabrand.com/switchblade. That's 20% off your first order at betabrand.com/switchblade. Millions of women agree these are the most comfortable pants you'll ever wear to work. So go to betabrand.com/switchblade for 20% off. And for all of those non-binary folks, too, who want to have some comfort, you know, definitely get into it.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we host
Round Springfield.
Round Springfield is a new Simpsons podcast that is Simpsons adjacent. Mm-hmm. In its topic, we talk to Simpsons writers, directors, voiceover actors, you name it, about non-Simpsons things that they've done because, surprise, they're all extremely talented.
Absolutely. For example, David X. Cohen worked on The Simpsons, but then created a little show called Futurama.
Mm-hmm.
That's our very first episode. So
yeah.
Tune in for stuff like that with Yardley Smith, with Tim Long, with different writers and voice actors. It's going to be so much fun. And we are every other week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Julia Prescott, and we're talking about Adam's family values.
Yeah.
So as promised, let me talk about some production design characteristics with you, because as you mentioned, they were amazing. Mm-hmm. Ken Adam is the production designer on this. He was actually nominated for, I think, an Oscar.
Cool.
For this. A lot of people probably know him more from his work on early James Bond films, actually.
Hell yeah.
He had worked in the business for forever. But he said, quote, "I said that I couldn't do much better than to try and bring the Adams cartoons to life because I think this man was a genius," talking about Charles Adams. "I made quite sure that I would go back to the Adams cartoons with a touch of Ken Adam thrown in. You see that in the small gallery running on top of Gomez's study, the bed in Wednesday's bedroom, the kitchen, the attic, the wallpaper, the out of plumb walls. I think in every room in the house, there are elements of Charles Adams. In Pubert's nursery, however, there was no Adams prototype, so I tried to go back to the Charles Adams style of drawing certain animals, grotesque ones, to be sure."
Mm-hmm.
So he was really looking at kind of making the house cartoonish.
Yeah, and that's felt, but it also feels inhabited in a way that is kind of grounded in its own bizarre way. Again, like, you enter this world and it is coming at you so bright and confident, and I, as a viewer, just immediately accept it. And so I feel like the Addams Family house and the Addams Family, just in like how they look at the world, is where we are grounded.
Yes.
And everything else is an extension of that. So yeah. It's that's, I think, also why I didn't bat an eye when the kids were trying to bounce the baby off the roof, because it felt like we were in a cartoony world and there was like no consequence to what their actions were going to be.
Well, I mean, since we're talking about cartoons and you work a lot in animation, you know, I mean, there is a freedom to animation in
absolutely.
A way that there's not a freedom to, live action.
Mm-hmm.
Work.
Yeah. And it's not just, I have this argument with people all the time where I think the outsider perspective of animation writing specifically is like, well, you have all the freedom because you can make a dinosaur talk. And it's like, yeah, sure. But I think that not a lot of people are considering how you could make a character endearing despite doing terrible things. You know, if we're talking about The Simpsons, Homer is a character that if it were a live action show, we would hate him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would be like what I imagine that Kevin James riffing show that's about to come out. Kevin can go fuck himself if you've heard about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It would be sort of that version where he is, you know, someone we despise that we want to take down. But because I think it is within the world of animation, we not only suspend our disbelief in a way where we don't think that, you know, direct terrible consequences are going to come from their actions, but there is just something generally endearing about watching a drawn character go about their day and go about a plot so that you kind of have your sympathies already aligned with them.
Yeah. And I think that also, I mean, if we're talking about, let's talk about adapting something that is drawn or animated for live action in the same way that this is, it is hard to get that right and to get that tone and to feel like there's a cartoonishness to it that that gives you that suspension of disbelief and suspension of morality.
Yeah.
Unless you have the budget and the means.
Yes.
Because otherwise, if it looks too real, it's just, it's not going to fly. You're still going to have that thing where you're not into the character. Like,
yeah,
it's just not okay.
That makes me think of, it's the first time I've thought about this in a long time, but if you recall, I think it was like in the early 2000s, they were doing the Munsters reboot, and it was like Jerry O'Connell and a bunch of other people, and it was like this really bizarre, photorealistic in the way of the design of the house and the design of their makeup, and it was shot very flat, kind of like the WB shows of that time, mm-hmm. the OC, etc. And, you know, I think there's a reason why I think only the pilot came out and then it was quickly axed, because it just didn't have that same magic as the original, and
mm-hmm.
it didn't have, maybe it did have the budget, maybe it didn't. They didn't channel it in a way that I think the people that did Adam's Family did, and didn't have that mind of, well, we need to have this balance of cartoony and real, and, you know, not just like make it this cookie cutter primetime show on WB.
So I do want to get into Joan Cusack and villains.
Yes.
Producer David Nixay said, Joan Cusack brings a kind of unpredictability to the role that is wonderful. What's very important in a movie like this is that the villain be great. And like Batman had a great villain in Jack Nicholson as the Joker, Joan Cusack adds that same kind of energy to this story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd never made that sort of connection because, again, that was a movie that came out sort of around the same time. But I knew her from this, and I also had seen her in Toys, I want to say,
oh, yeah.
And like a bunch of other roles. And I'd already recognized her, I think, as a child watching this movie. She was very appealing to me because she does have a quality that I think it's so larger than life that I think is very, it can resonate with a child viewer very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt like, you know, I read somewhere in research for this that the difference between the Addams Family and specifically Fester and his energy of being this sort of like unhinged, monstrous energy, but in a very positive way, he's sort of like chaotic good and she is chaotic evil.
Yeah.
And it's just really interesting to see, you know, the Addams Family in the previous film, it was this sort of one joke run of them being the oddballs out and that there's nobody weirder than the Addams Family and everybody else is sort of the straight man for
it. Yeah, they will top you, yes.
Yeah, and then to introduce this character who is not that. She is crazy in her own way. And there's a timeline, there's like a sliding doors parallel reality where I can see her getting along so well with the Adamses. Like there's so many similarities. And you even hear it from Morticia when she says she like respects her hustle, basically, for trying to kill.
Well, she's just like compassionate and she's just like oh.
And I just love Angelica Houston in that moment.
You did have to kill them.
Yeah.
I understand, you know, like she should have been playing by the Addams Family rules, you know.
Right. Yeah. And but that also gives way to some really, really great jokes. There's a lot of really great one-liners in this movie that I feel like definitely makes it stand out, you know, a step above the previous movie where they visit Debbie and Fester in their new suburban home. And Morticia has like this whole run of lines.
You have married Fester. You have destroyed his spirit. You have taken him from us. All that I could forgive. But Debbie...
What?
Pastels? Get out of my house!
You know, and you get that moment from her. It's so great. Again, just sort of making us think like in a perfect world, they would really get along if she just didn't have this plan in motion and wanted to win.
Yeah. You just have to do it as a family. You know, you can't do it rogue. You need to do it together.
I know. I mean, and then in the way we're talking about it now, it makes me think of Avengers. It is truly the Avengers of the 90s of you have to work together. You can't separate or else trouble will happen. I haven't seen many of the Avengers movies.
It's definitely I'm going to tell you
exactly
the same as
the Avengers.
And we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I think that it's necessary to say that the kind of premise for this movie and the play on the title, Addams Family Values, was taken from Dan Quayle and the 1992 LA riots, because Dan Quayle blamed the unrest on the breakdown of family values. Pretty racist, very classist,
yeah.
All of those things. And so Debbie as a character was something that Rudnick was writing in, and Barry Sonnenfeld, too, was very interested in this, of exploring what family values are to certain people. And so Debbie is the kind of like this embodiment of those kind of conservative family values that you're talking about with Kathy Lee Gifford.
Mm-hmm.
And this like, this is America, you know?
Right. Yeah. And it's funny because, and maybe you read the same interview, too, they did. There was an anniversary for this movie. I want to say maybe last year was like the 25th anniversary or something like that. And in that interview, I think Barry and David were both like, yes, it was very political. And that was sort of the headline that went with that interview with the whole cast, you know, of what they were trying to do with the family values title. But it was funny to read it and to read from the cast, and especially people like Christina Ricci and the other kids that were in the movie, and their reaction being like, was it political? I don't know. Like,
No idea.
I thought it was great. And then, yeah, I think Christina Ricci was like, yeah, I remember thinking it was cool. My role had been expanded. Anyway, it was so funny to have that in the same, I want to say, Variety article of like, yes, we were on the forefront of making a statement, which is another thing that I don't really think that broad comedies in the mainstream moment we're currently in have a mind to do, nonetheless, get away with.
No. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about character development from movie to movie. And we're also going to talk about Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
So gear up for that and a couple other things, too. We'll be right back.
Hey, gang, Jesse here, the founder of Maximum Fun. And with me is Stacey Molsky, who is, among other things, the lady who responds to all of your tweets.
Hi, everyone. I also send you newsletters.
So anyway, something really awesome. You, Max Fun listeners, have given us the chance to do something really cool on behalf of our entire community, and we wanted to tell you about it.
Last summer, following the Max Fun Drive, we put all of the enamel pins on sale to $10 and up members, with proceeds going to the National CASA GAL Association for Children.
Your generous support and enthusiasm raised over $100,000. Our bookkeeper, Steph, would be quick to tell me the exact total is $109,025, to be exact.
Your money will go toward pairing kids who've experienced abuse or neglect with court-appointed advocates or guardian ad litem volunteers.
In other words, kids in tough spots will have somebody in their corner. Knowledgeable grown-ups who are on their team through court dates and life upheavals and confusing situations, whatever.
The money we raise together is going to help a lot of kids.
Whether you bought pins or not, you can help us build on that $109,000 foundation. Make a donation to support National CASA GAL and help some of our nation's most vulnerable children at MaximumFund.org/CASA. That's MaximumFund.org/CASA.
And seriously, thank you. Our community rules.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Julia Prescott, and we're talking about Adam's Family Values. Okay, I have a quote here from Barry Sonnenfeld, because he has very, very thoughtful about character, which is something that I appreciate in a director, and it's also something I appreciate in a cinematographer, which is what he was doing, you know, before these movies. He said, quote, "The Adams are the ultimate functional family. The parents love the children. The mother and father love each other. They don't change their values based on a whim. They're a perfect family. It's an interesting thing making a sequel to The Addams Family, because there are certain characters who can change and grow and become different. And there are other characters who the audience does not want to see change. For instance, you wouldn't want to make a movie where Gomez and Morticia get a divorce. They have a perfect relationship. You wouldn't want to see Wednesday be any more evil or deadpan, or Pugsley to be any more less goofy. At the beginning of the movie, we find that Fester is very lonely. He realizes that everyone's very happy. The family has another baby, and Fester is lonely. He wants a mate, but Fester, he can change."
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a really smart thing that they did to not mess with these archetypes that they already created that were solid, and to not shake the foundation of people's trust.
Yeah,
in
and
a
I
sense.
Think that's so hard to do with a sequel.
Yes.
Where, you know, you want to not just do a carbon copy of the first one. You want to progress it and expand the universe in some way that feels meaningful. And even though we as an audience are savvy enough to know that a lot of sequels are cash grabs,
mm-hmm.
There still needs to be a reason why we're revisiting, you know, this one world, and what further stories are begged to be told.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt like choosing Fester, especially considering the first movie was an introduction to him,
mm-hmm.
I felt like that sort of implied that his story is evolving in real time,
mm-hmm.
and thus incomplete. And so to have him be kind of the main focus of change in this was so smart. And, you know, I also thought that, you know, when you have kid characters, that I feel in lesser hands would be the target for this change, because somebody would go, oh, they're going through puberty, and, you know, Wednesday gets her first boyfriend, and I think in lesser hands that would have been made into this big coming of age moment. But that's not the tone of what this world and what these movies are.
Because it doesn't change her.
No.
Like, she's already set.
She changes her boyfriend, we see by the end. He looks
exactly
like her father, which we shall unpack on another day.
Let's switch into some darker things. Michael Jackson.
Yeah. That was a surprise in this latest viewing. I mean, I had...
There's more surprises, too.
I bet. And it's very brief, but it's very impactful when
you see it. We should explain, too, that the character of Joel, Dave Krumholtz, his character is kind of getting undressed in a room, and he looks over and there is a poster of Michael Jackson looking at him, and he's like, ah! And he screams and he lets out like a shriek. So it's just like, it's baked into, like, we know the rumors.
Right.
But the thing is that before they had started shooting, those were just like so under the radar rumors. They weren't up yet. Like, this, the dentist had not accused Michael Jackson of molesting his son yet. Mm-hmm. And so it was just something that, like, was in the cultural consciousness, but people weren't taking, like, too seriously. They were like, yeah, we all know, whatever. And then that joke is in there. And here's the other layer of it. Michael Jackson had recorded a song for the movie. He was supposed, you know how, like, Hammer did the first song?
Yeah.
Michael Jackson actually did this song, and there is a video for it. There is a film, a short film with a lot of well-known character actors, and it's available. You can watch it because it's mostly finished. The song isn't in there, but the film itself is there.
Wow.
And so you can find it on YouTube. And one of the reasons I think that they decided not to do it is because if you watch it, it is essentially a defense of him spending time alone with children. And the adults don't get it. And the adults think it's too weird and scary. But the children know that Michael is not scary. If you watch this, please, please, please.
Oh my gosh.
I would love to hear what people think about this. But the song was called originally, Is It Scary? Sometimes people call it Adam's Groove Family Thing. But the title of this short film and what the song was supposed to be is It Scary? It's very risque for that. And I'm really glad that they dumped it. It would have been insane to have that come out at the exact same time that there is, you know, like a very real case going on accusing him of some very terrible things. But it was an essentially a defense of...
Oh, my God. I mean, I'm sure we've all seen the Leaving Neverland documentary series by now. And just you describing that put me right back in the most terrible parts of that documentary, which is pretty much all of it. And, you know, how a predator could reframe things in a way, especially to innocent children. Ah, it's just like... It's so gnarly. I can't even. And I'm. Yeah.
But it was a coincidence that they had the Michael Jackson poster playing a gag in this movie.
Was it?
He was doing a song, because those were decisions made in two separate
places.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's such a machine, especially from such a big studio, that like they're just the marketing department is completely separate from the screenwriters and the people actually making the film.
No, absolutely.
Thank God. Because I mean, I'm not sure what it would have done to the legacy of this film, but it would have been definitely a stain in a way that, you know, it's all right that it's not part of it.
Switching gears out of Michael.
Yes.
The characters who didn't seem to be huge in this movie, Sonnenfeld was still extremely specific with how and who he wanted to be in this movie. The level of detail that he had was just, I think, incredible. For instance, Thing.
Yeah.
That was Christopher Hart playing that. I mean, it's a hand, but he's playing it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, quote, Thing had to have his own weight as a character. So I had to make sure that my wrist was at a certain angle over my hand so that when my body was taking off, it would look correct. And of course, I had to consider the performance aspects, what his personality was like and how he moved. I see Thing as a lovable little character. He's like a little puppy dog in that he likes to play practical jokes. He's a kid at heart, but he's also obviously very intelligent and cares about his family. He's willing to put his life on the in the line and put himself in danger to save them.
Absolutely comes across. I just remember there's a really great sequence in the beginning of the movie where you see, and so most of this movie is practical effects, and I was really impressed in rewatching it now of how well the special effects for Thing look, mm-hmm. and you know how well it's aged. But there's a whole sequence of hopping on a skateboard and sort of like almost a Rube Goldberg type sequence of going through the house, which is also a really great introduction to the house. But you sense that exact personality through Thing, and I remember even as a child being like, oh, that's my friend. I'm happy he's here.
Yeah, you don't think of it as a hand. You
no.
think of it as a character.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a character, which I found delightful to know that this actor really took this quite seriously and that he and Sonnenfeld, that scene in particular, the skateboarding scene, they rehearsed it quite a bit to get the right emotion and the right action. And like, it seems silly. It does. But if it's a character, then it's going to be a character.
But that's the best part. I mean, if we're talking about why we do this, the best days that I have working in this town is when I go, this is the silliest, stupidest thing. I can't believe it's coming to life.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to do it. Here we go. Like when I am talking very seriously about a very stupid subject, but it is what we are writing about, what we are making, those are the best days in working. Because it's like, I went to college, you know, like,
yep.
Here we are. My grandparents did something noble. And I'm here talking about, you know, how big the necklace on a horse who is a love interest of one of my characters in the Western should be. You know, it's those are the best days for me. And you get it especially a lot in animation, of course.
Yeah. I mean, take being silly seriously.
Oh my God, it's my favorite. Dumb things are the best.
Julia, what do you have to plug? What's coming up for you?
Well, I have a Simpsons-themed podcast called Round Springfield. So as you mentioned up top, this is a podcast that my co-host Allie Gertz and I have done for a little while. And previously it was called Everything's Coming Up Simpsons, where we would interview people about their favorite Simpsons episode. We have since restructured our premise and now it is called Round Springfield. We are interviewing people that have worked on The Simpsons, whether as a writer, a director, showrunner, voiceover actor. We had a great episode with Yardley Smith and we talked to them about non-Simpsons things, shows that they've written on, pilots that have failed. You know, Yardley talked about growing up in the theater and what that was like. So, you know, it's a series. If you like The Simpsons, of course, that'll not naturally filter in. But it is us profiling the brilliant people that make the greatest show on the planet
mm-hmm.
and all the other amazing things that they do. It is a 20-episode season that is releasing right now. You can listen to our episode of David X. Cohen talking about Futurama and all other fun things now. So that's on Maximum Fun. And if you're in the LA area, I host a monthly show called the JP Lecture Series, based off my initials. And it's at the Lyric Hyperion, and it's a show where I curate a panel of industry professionals about many different topics, but they all kind of circulate around breaking into the industry. So we'll have shows that are titled, How Do You Get a Manager? Or How Do You Get a Pitch Meeting? And I'll have a panel of people that are on both sides of the table. So development execs and show creators. And then I also do fun ones where it'll be inside the writer's room of fill in the blank. So we've done inside the writer's room of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. We've done Rick and Morty. I had a panel with Simpsons showrunners. And so you can catch that at the Lyric once a month. It's usually the third Saturday, but check on their schedule and check on my Twitter because sometimes it may change. And it's always a good time. People bring notebooks. They take copious notes and it kind of feels like, you know, comedy grad school in a way. Though
yeah.
we do talk about dramas too. I'm just a comedy gal, so that's sort of where I'm going to go.
And then people can also watch Townies on their phone.
They can watch Townies on their phone if you can download the Black Pills app. You can watch Townies. Hopefully more people get to see it because I'm really proud of what we made.
And we'll just kind of keep an eye out for something from Disney. For
yeah, in like 3 years, because animation takes a long time.
3 years later, okay.
Oh, and then, I mean, well, speaking of animation, you can catch the Treehouse of Horror episode I wrote later
speaking
this
of
year.
Animation.
So that'll be the first one that comes out.
Oh, thank you so much, Julie,
thank
for joining
you.
Us.
This has been such a treat.
And thank you all for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Oh, He's Just Joking, Right? said, for the last 2 weeks, I've been telling my friends again and again about the movie Ravenous, and suddenly Ravenous episode drops on Switchblade Sisters. I'm envious of anybody who learned about that movie by listening to that episode. This is a really informative and very entertaining podcast. April Wolf is a great interviewer while themselves being very engaging and their enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is infectious. Also, go check out Who Shot Ya podcast, for which Wolf used to serve as a regular host. That's true. I was a regular panel co-host on that. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
You're a big, dumb, weird thing!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.